How did a ranking officer in Hitler's SS become an American hero? Wernher von Braun, Hitler's chief rocketeer and later a star at NASA, was the highest profile beneficiary of Operation Paperclip, the U.S. military's covert effort to import 1,600 Nazi scientists who had developed rockets and chemical and biological weapons for Hitler. They were brought here to Maryland at Edgewood Arsenal and at an army lab in Frederick to help the U.S. prepare for a total war with the Soviets that never happened. Journalist Annie Jacobson has new details about the scope of the government's effort to cover up their complicity in some of Hitler's worst atrocities, often so they could do the same morally repugnant research for us. Annie Jacobson tells the story of Operation Paperclip on Midday After the News. And welcome back to Midday, our second hour. Dan Roderick's here. It's hard to get through our next guest's book without feeling outrage. True, it's no secret that our military brought German scientists over here after World War II to prepare for a war against the Soviets, but journalist Annie Jacobson has written a disturbing account of the lies, deception, and moral ambiguity surrounding Operation Paperclip, as the program was euphemistically nicknamed. She says newly declassified documents, interviews with relatives, and research in National Archives proves many of these scientists weren't just loyal technocrats, but high-ranking, dedicated Nazis. In her words, a tawdry group of amoral war opportunists, many of whom were linked to war crimes. She also documents the extraordinary efforts of the U.S. military to obfuscate their backgrounds because it desperately wanted German expertise in aeronautics, rocketry, biological and chemical warfare to defeat first the Japanese and then prepare for war with the Soviet Union. We know that didn't happen, but what did, according to Annie Jacobson, was a covert campaign to bring these Nazi scientists and their families into the U.S., regardless of their war crimes. Most wound up living comfortably here, paid well, and even honored for the same work that would have otherwise made them war criminals. The most famous was Wernher von Braun, as it turns out, a high-ranking officer in Hitler's SS who personally traveled to the Buchenwald concentration camp to handpick slave laborers for his Nordhausen V2 factory, where 30,000 died of starvation, beatings, and disease. Von Braun's reward, star billing at NASA, where he was known as father of the Saturn V rocket. Or Major General Walter Schreiber, Hitler's surgeon general and biological warfare expert, whose minions performed unspeakable experiments on concentration camp prisoners. He hired on with the U.S. Air Force in Texas. Or Otto Ambrose, a chemist awarded 1 million Reichsmarks by Hitler himself. Ambrose was actually convicted of mass murder and slavery at Auschwitz, but pardoned by the U.S. High Commissioner. Some of these scientists, including von Braun, contributed to U.S. security during a scary period when many thought war with the Soviets was inevitable. But others jump-started dubious U.S. efforts to create nerve agents, mind-control drugs, and biological weapons that were still trying to destroy. Still others were outright frauds. The ultimate question, the author of this book says, is moral relativity. Can we gloss over mass murder when it suits our purposes? Annie Jacobson is a freelance journalist who writes about national security and intelligence issues. She demonstrated her toughness years ago as a member of Princeton University's women's ice hockey team. Annie Jacobson's first book addressed one of the government's deepest secrets, what really happened in Area 51, the mysterious air base in the Nevada desert. Her new book takes on this topic of Operation Paperclip. That's its title, Operation Paperclip, the secret intelligence program that brought Nazi scientists to America. Annie Jacobson, thank you very much for being on our show today on Midday on WYPR.
Thank you for having me.
Where did the plan hatch? When and where did this plan hatch, this idea? Where did it percolate and when?
Well, for exactly those reasons, to answer that question, I begin the book in November of 1944. It's just a few months after the landings at Normandy, and the Allied troops are trying to liberate Strasbourg, France. And situated among the soldiers is a scientific intelligence unit from America, an offshoot of the Manhattan Project. That's how Secret Paperclip began. But the origins are called Operation Alsace. It's led by a particle physicist named Samuel Goudsmit, and he and his team of scientists are looking for what was called ABC warfare, atomic, biological, and chemical. And very quickly, we found out that the Reich's atomic program was not nearly as great of a program as we had feared. But we also learned that the biological weapons and the chemical weapons were far beyond the scope of anything anyone, us or Britain, could have imagined. And there began the real understanding by the Allies that we had to find these weapons, and ultimately we had to find the scientists who created them. That's the origin of Operation Paperclip.
The fear was that they would be used against Allied troops. The fear was that they would be used, get into the hands of the Soviets after the war.
Absolutely. And, you know, keep in mind that in June of 1944 is when the Reich began lobbing these V-2 rockets at European cities. And while the rockets themselves were not terribly target friendly, let's say, they would miss their targets. They would just sort of be lobbed over at a city and explode wherever they did. They wreaked this kind of psychological havoc, in addition to killing thousands of people, but they just terrified everybody, the population. What really terrified the administration, both U.S. and in Great Britain, was that in the nose cone of these rockets, Hitler could put either a biological weapon or a chemical weapon. And so there was that fear of them, these weapons being used in rockets, and then there was also the fear of these weapons being used on the battlefield as the Allies moved toward Berlin and Munich.
Fear of, but were they ever used? We know that the Nazis used chemicals to kill many Jews in the concentration camps, but what about on the field of battle?
Mm-hmm. Well, they were not used, and this remains one of the great mysteries why they were not used, particularly the chemical weapons, because Hitler had this expansive program with sarin gas, which people are familiar with because of what's going on in Syria today. But the precursor to sarin gas was something called tabun gas. And the Reich had these enormous warehouses and bunkers filled with bombs ready to be loaded onto Luftwaffe airplanes and dropped, and yet they never were.
Speaking of tabun and that kind of gas, this deadly gas, because we're broadcasting out of Baltimore here in Maryland, I want to ask you about Operation Paperclip as it pertains to this state. Two locations, mm-hmm. Edgewood Arsenal, and this, of course, would be after World War II, and what became known as Fort Detrick in Frederick, Maryland. Let's start with Edgewood Arsenal. And what did you learn about what happened there?
Well, the Nazis who became part of our chemical weapons program were brought to Edgewood. And that is where we began developing our nerve agent programs, starting with tabun and then quickly moving over to sarin. And what was remarkable to me, as I write in the book, is some of these Nazis were so close to Hitler, you know, really in his inner circle, wore, for example, what was called the Golden Party Badge, indicating favor by the Führer. And some of these guys, like Otto Ambrose, were actually facing trial at Nuremberg. And at the same time, we were trying to give them contracts to, you know, beef up our chemical weapons program. And what happened was while the big heavy hitters were on trial at Nuremberg, we brought some of the lighter weight, so to speak, Nazi chemists here over to Edgewood. And they were unable to produce Tabun and then sarin on an industrial scale. So we were able to make it in small quantities, but not, you know, industrialized. And so we waited until some of these guys were out of, we released them out of Nuremberg prison, and then set them up in these secret round tables over in U.S.-occupied Germany, getting the so-called recipes from them, and then putting this massive program into production back here in the United States.
I see. And those who were doing this work for us in Germany, post-World War Germany, we weren't able to bring them to this country. I mean, there was some concern that, some of these guys had been so close to Hitler that they could not justify bringing them into the country without greater controversy.
I mean, that's exactly it. And what was so remarkable as I did this research and uncovered things through Freedom of Information Acts and often, you know, going straight to, like, for in one example, the general in charge of this program, a fellow named Brigadier General Charles Lukes, he was head of the U.S. Chemical Corps in America and then was restationed over in Germany. And he developed this fondness for these high-ranking Hitler inner circle chemists and would invite them to his home. I learned this in his diaries, which are at a military institute in Pennsylvania. And you can begin to piece together this long-lost story of the push and pull between some generals in the Pentagon. The program Operation Paperclip was run out of the Pentagon. The Joint Chiefs were in charge of it. And many of the Joint Chiefs were loath to bring these Nazis to the United States. And you see that tension in these documents, you know, some of them saying, essentially, over my dead body, will this guy come here to the United mm-hmm. States? And then you see others who want the scientist for his acumen, and they don't care about his past, and they don't care about how close he was to Hitler or to Himmler, and they say so. And that push and pull is incredibly tense. And as you said, what ends up happening is some of these guys, it just becomes clear we cannot bring them here. And you see that in the dialogue and the transcripts. And so they're stationed in, you know, working for the United States and Germany. But then as the Cold War heats up and the war in Korea happens, all bets are off, and suddenly we begin bringing over to the United States some of the, you know, worst Nazis imaginable.
So that push and pull, Annie Jacobson, that push and pull is about the Cold War. You have Cold War warriors saying, well, if we don't bring these guys into our fold, and if they don't work for us, they're going to end up working for the Russians, for the Soviets.
Absolutely, and I think that's what makes Paperclip, the whole program, such an enigma, because you can see the tension, and you can imagine if you try to put yourself in the shoes of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and understand the intelligence that they're getting, which is essentially, quote, you know, prepare for total war with the Soviets to include atomic, biological, and chemical weapons. This is what the Joint Intelligence Committee was telling the Joint Chiefs. They even set a start date of 1952. And then the idea beyond that is, if we don't get these scientists, Hitler scientists, who were the experts in atomic, biological, and chemical warfare and rocketry, then the Soviets will.
And back to Edgewood, once more before we take our first break with you, Annie. Testing was done there, testing on U.S. soldiers post-World War II.
And that's where it just moves from dramatic to spooky to amoral, where you see decisions being made by high-ranking officers to test this Tabun gas on our own soldiers. And so on the one hand, there we are prosecuting the Nuremberg doctors' trial for using humans in experiments during the war. And at the same time, almost the same time, there we are testing soldiers with Tabun under this kind of vague or rather opaque arrangement that it's with consent, when in fact all of the tests are classified. So the soldier who is consenting to being tested with Tabun gas has no idea what he's being tested with.
Do we have any idea how many were tested in that period?
Well, congressional reports in the 70s put the figure, you know, anywhere between 5,000 and 10,000. And more information continues to be revealed about the scope of these programs, which began, well, they certainly were going on during World War II, but post-war programs beginning right after the war, going all the way through the 1970s.
Annie Jacobson is a journalist and the author of the New York Times bestseller, Area 51. Her new book is called Operation Paperclip, the secret intelligence program that brought Nazi scientists to America. Little Brown is the publisher. Well worth the read, based on newly declassified documents, interviews with relatives of these men, and research into archives on two continents. Annie shows just how much effort the U.S. military expended to cover up the fact that many of these scientists weren't good German soldiers and technocrats doing their duty. That was the official line, but many were in fact ardent and even high-ranking Nazis who were involved or complicit in unspeakable war crimes. More about this when we get back. More Midday just ahead. And this is Midday. Dan Rodrigues here. My guest this hour is Annie Jacobson, a freelance journalist who specializes in national security and intelligence issues. Her book, Operation Paperclip, the secret intelligence program that brought Nazi scientists to America. The president at the time was Harry Truman. What did the president know about this, and what did the president say about this?
The president was briefed on the program. What he really knew about the individual scientists remains unknown, and I would say probably he didn't know the specifics. There would be that idea to keep the president immune from the real truth about what was in the foreign scientist case files. But he did endorse the program. And also what's interesting to remember is that although Operation Paperclip as a whole was a classified military program, it had a public face. The War Department issued a press release saying, "We are bringing the good German scientists here to help America in this time of peace and prosperity." And that idea carried through with some questions. You know, here and there, certain scientists, Albert Einstein among them, really took to task saying, wait a minute, how could an individual in Nazi Germany at the top of his field, as the majority of these scientists were, not adhere to the Nazi Party ideals, mindful of the fact that, you know, the Nazi Party was very clear that you had to adhere to their ideals, otherwise you were taken care of in a different manner.
Mm-hmm. Wernher Braun Vaughn, this is a great time to bring him up because he benefited from this public relations campaign probably more than any of these fellows, wouldn't you say? Sort of the poster child for how it was presented to the public.
Yes, and that's a very important part of the legacy of Operation Paperclip, is looking at how the United States government, different services, were complicit in helping an individual like Von Braun conceal his Nazi past. There was no way that America could handle this idea that America's space prophet was complicit in Nazi ideology. And so a very concerted effort was made to keep Von Braun, in that, cast in that light of being the good German scientist. There's a couple interesting quotes that I found in some transcripts that he had with different NASA officials. And he was often reminded to say what he had always said, which is, whenever it came up and anyone asked him about his Nazi past, what he did during the war, he would say, "I have been thoroughly investigated by the U.S. military," as he had.
Mm-hmm. He denied that he knew anything about the slave labor used at Nordhausen?
Yes, he would always evade that subject, and it was actually the historian Michael Neufeld who found the document in the Bundesarchive in Germany that showed a correspondence between von Braun and the commandant at Buchenwald concentration camp, which reveals this devastating information that von Braun himself would go to Buchenwald and pick prisoners who would then become slave laborers assembling the rockets at this horrific underground factory called Nordhausen.
You know, I remember growing up with Wernher von Braun and the astronaut program in the United States, the space program in the 60s. We didn't know any of that stuff. I think we knew, my parents knew that he was he had been a German scientist, but he was one of the good ones who came over to help us out.
I think absolutely.
Yeah, that's
yes.
The story. That's the storyline. What about Arthur Rudolph, though? Now he was a colleague of von Braun, and he worked also on the Saturn V project. What happened to him? And well, who was he anyway? I think our listeners need to know a little more about Arthur Rudolph.
Yes, Rudolph. You know, he specialized in V-weapon assembly, and so, well, if you look at his American persona, he was the father of the Saturn rocket. But if you look at what he was doing during the war, he worked with von Braun in this underground factory, and he was actually in charge of the operations. And so he was very complicit in what was going on with the deaths of 30,000 slave laborers assembling these rockets. And he was one of the few people that was revealed to be a Nazi. He was an ardent Nazi. He even had a quote once that said, "I read Mein Kampf and agreed with lots of things in it." Hitler's first 6 years up until the war started were really marvelous. This, of course, didn't come out until the 80s when the Department of Justice investigated Rudolph, and they determined, based on transcripts that had been available to the U.S. Army when Rudolph was recruited for Operation Paperclip in 1946, but then classified all the way until the Department of Justice got a hold of them in the 80s. And they, DOJ, gave Rudolph an ultimatum. They said, you can either stand trial here in the United States, or you can go back to Germany. And he chose to go back to Germany.
To avoid prosecution.
Yes.
Yeah. Annie Jacobson, our guest in this hour of midday, her book Operation Paperclip, the secret intelligence program that brought Nazi scientists to America. That's sort of an innocuous sounding name for a program like this, a covert operation. How did it get its name, Paperclip? What does it mean?
Well, that tug of war we were talking about earlier between those in the Pentagon who were loath to bring these Nazi scientists to the United States and those in Germany who were involved in the recruiting, that tension between them would often result in a snafu. Kurt Debus is one example. He's known as the, he's the first director of the JFK Space Center, and he was a quote-unquote vicious and ardent Nazi. Certain individuals in the United States were making very clear in this now declassified documents, we cannot bring this guy to the United States. And others were saying, well, we must have him. And things got hung up if you had an individual who was anti the program. Mm-hmm. And so a little system was established where they would take a file, a foreign scientist case file, who had a Kurt Debus-like problem with their past, and they would simply put a paperclip on the top of the file. And then those in the know would be aware of the fact that those files needed to go to people who were pro-paperclip and not against it. And actually, that's how the program got its name.
Annie, we mentioned, and you described what happened at Edgewood Arsenal here in Maryland, and then there's Fort Detrick, or what's now what became known as Fort Detrick. Then it was a farm, an army installation in Frederick, Maryland, used for what purpose, and then what happened there in terms of the Operation Paperclip and these scientists?
Well, Detrick, it's such an interesting part of the story. America had a biological weapons program during World War II. And it was completely classified. It was taking place at what was then called Camp Detrick. But after the war in 1946, it was made public that we had this program. And the reason that it was made public was because the idea was, look, we've had this secret program. Now it needs to be made public, and now we need a lot more money from Congress to actually beef up this program because the Soviets have a biological weapons program. And that's exactly what happened. But what wasn't made public was that some of the Reich's ranking biological weapons experts, including Dr. Kurt Blomma, who was tried at Nuremberg, acquitted, and immediately began working for the U.S. government, including, as you mentioned in your introduction, Major General Dr. Walter Schreiber, the Surgeon General of the Reich, who was working on the vaccine program for these biological weapons. He became part of Paperclip, and others. Some of them came to Dietrich, and others consulted for us in at a base, a secret base we set up in Germany called Camp King.
You mentioned Dr. Walter Schreiber, Major General Dr. Walter Schreiber, Hitler's Surgeon General, the biological warfare expert. I mean, this story, he worked for the Air Force, right? And there's a particular officer in the Air Force, a General Otis Benson, who his reaction to the complaints that Schreiber was, serving in this role, he blamed the resultant commotion on an organized medical movement against him by medical men of Jewish ancestry. There's that. And then the Pentagon ultimately arranges for Schreiber to flee to Argentina.
The whole story of Schreiber is just, it seems apocryphal. It seems like it's made up, except for there is all this documentation that shows that it is actually the cold, hard truth. And when you think of Schreiber as the Surgeon General of the Third Reich, I mean, you just have to shake your head and wonder. But the reason why he became so valuable to the Americans was because at the fall of Berlin, he was actually captured by the Russians. And so he was a prisoner of the Russians for several years. He actually was a surprise witness at the first Nuremberg trial for the Soviets, who had him testify against his fellow Nazi high command, and then they whisked him back to the Soviet Union and were in the process of making him Surgeon General of East Germany when supposedly Schreiber defected to the United States. And then you see all this questioning in the documentation saying, could he be a spy? And very quickly the United States decides, well, no, he's not a spy, but he needs to work for us now. And he is one of the very high-ranking Nazi, they were called Nazi Bonzen, that wanted big wheels, that means, that we wanted to bring to the United States. But he was so high up, there was just no way. So we put him in this place, Camp King in Germany, and then eventually, as I said earlier, the Cold War heats up, and before you know it, he's on his way to Texas to work at the Randolph Air Force Base there.
At the time, was there any press reporting on this at the time, Annie?
Well, that is, I love it when fate and circumstance sort of work into a story where you just think this is just going from bad to worse. And that is certainly the case with Schreiber, because one of the chief medical investigators during the Nuremberg trial, and perhaps the only hero in the Paperclip story, is a man named Dr. Leopold Alexander. And he was very familiar with the crimes of Dr. Walter Schreiber, but we couldn't prosecute him because the Russians had him. And Schreiber, working with that idea of hubris, once he arrives in the United States at Randolph Air Force Base, he gives an interview to a medical journal. And that is the beginning of his downfall, because lo and behold, who subscribes to and reads that medical journal but Dr. Leopold Alexander? Far away in Boston, he reads it. He is astonished that we must have made some huge mistake. How could this, wanted war criminal be working for us now? He writes letters to everybody involved, and he's kind of shut down. And when that doesn't work, he goes to the press. He goes to the Boston Globe. They break the story, and there begins this very dramatic, almost unbelievable story of how Dr. Schreiber is finally revealed to be living in Texas. And just when you think he might be prosecuted, instead, he is shuttled away to Argentina by the U.S. Air Force.
Annie, Jacobson, our guest in this hour of the show. I'm just amazed by was that a wow moment for you? Because I have this question I wanted to ask you. With all of this information, this newly declassified stuff, the archives, I wondered what your wow moment was, because there have been stories about Operation Paperclip. There's an earlier book I noted from the 1990s on it. Was this story, I mean, the fact that we would help Schreiber get off to Argentina, is that one of your wow moments, or can you name another one?
Yes, I'm sure.
That one is for me, I guess.
I'll tell you, in the world of journalism, we have a lot of wow moments, and they go right up to the present. Yesterday, I spent about 90 minutes on the telephone with Major General Dr. Walter Schreiber's 80-year-old son, who was privy to all of this. So, in other words, he read my book when it published a month ago and contacted me. And, you know, he has a very different take on what his father did, although... And this is these are the wow moments. I mean, so much of it lines up historically, but I think that when you're dealing with the truth and you're dealing with the complicated truth, what remains interesting and infinitely enigmatic is this idea that there's all different sides of the truth. And more always gets revealed. And that was certainly the case in my, writing and researching this book.
Annie Jacobson, our guest, Operation Paperclip, her book, Operation Paperclip, the U.S. military's covert effort to import 1,600 Nazi scientists who had developed rockets and chemical and biological weapons for Hitler. They were brought here, some of them to Maryland, Edgewood Arsenal, the Army Lab in Frederick, that became known as Fort Detrick, to help the U.S. prepare for a total war with the Soviets that never happened. Well, more on this with Annie Jacobs when we get back. And with journalist Annie Jacobson talking about her book, Operation Paperclip, the secret intelligence program that brought Nazi scientists to America, published by Little Brown. Annie, I want to do the hindsight is 2020 question with you here. Because that's what some people would say. It was the Cold War. It was a different era. You can understand that push and pull. You can understand the push to bring these scientists in to the fold here, get them on our side. And you have to understand what the times. But the fact is, there was a push and pull. There were those who said, no, we shouldn't be doing this, right? It wasn't clear for everybody that this was the right thing to do.
Yes, that's absolutely right. I mean, and another, along those lines, another interesting element of this that was revealed as I was researching is that only a few individuals were privy to the true facts that would then be buried inside these foreign scientist case files. And so once the handler, so to speak, was able to get the dossier, get the scientist, cleared, then they were almost on a new path. Someone else described it as kind of, state-sponsored witness protection. Mm-hmm. In other words, with a classified file locked away, no one knew. And so there began their new image for themselves and their new life as a dedicated American scientist.
Were the scientists well paid?
Absolutely. I mean, on par, absolutely. And many of them also went on to, work for different military contractors. You know, one of the things that I think I aimed to do in the book was reconcile the difference between image and, or rather, presentation and truth. And I can think of no better example than Dr. Theodore Benziger. He actually worked at the Naval Medical Research Institute there in Maryland. And when he died, in his obituary in 1999 in the New York Times, spoke about this dedicated American scientist who had been born in Germany. And how he worked all his life for the military and did all this great research, and he even invented the ear thermometer. And Benziger died. He was 94 at the time. But in researching Benziger's story to come across the documents that put together the true facts of what he was doing for the war, in the war, that he was part of Himmler's inner circle of doctors, that when Himmler decided to show a film of concentration camp patients being murdered in medical experiments at the Reich, Himmler chose Dr. Theodor Benziger to give the opening remarks about this film. That Dr. Theodor Benziger was actually on the original list of those to be prosecuted at the Nuremberg doctor's trial. But mysteriously, he was released just 3 weeks before the trial into the arms of the U.S. Army Air Forces. And so to look at those two different things on balance, this man's obituary versus this man's early life, really suggests that there's so much more going on than one can see in the surface.
Right. My note on this in the Benziger story, my note for Annie is, can we forgive almost any crime, no matter how heinous, if we think there might be some benefit for us?
I mean, I leave that one up to the reader to decide.
Yeah. There's another name I want to mention here, and this is an American, John McCloy. I wanted to spend a little bit of time because this certainly is an interesting and important figure in this story of Operation Paperclip.
John? Yes. McCloy is such a, you know, to me, controversial figure. He's often portrayed as this giant, you know, this kind of great American. But, you know, McCloy, after he became the president of the World Bank, he was asked to be U.S. High Commissioner for Germany at a time that the country was moving from being under U.S. military control to having a commissioner and having this, you know, power-sharing situation with Konrad Adenauer. And at the time, there were nearly 1,000 convicted Nazi war criminals in Landsberg prison, many of whom had death sentences. And McCloy proceeded to grant clemency to the great majority of them. And when you look at the specifics of this story, you know, again, it's one of those situations where you shake your head and you just say, what? How could this have happened?
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, you just, it all had to do with the Cold War. It all had to do with the fact that the threat, you know, the threat was that the Soviets were going to invade West Germany from the east. And it was a very real threat. And the Adenauer administration wanted these war criminals released. They didn't see them as criminals. And that is exactly what happened. One of the worst criminals, Otto Ambrose, Hitler's favorite chemist, so favored by Hitler, he was given a 1 million Reichsmarks bonus by the Führer for his work on chemical weapons and also the invention of synthetic rubber for the Reich. Otto Ambrose, convicted of mass murder and slavery for his role at Auschwitz, was then granted clemency by John McCloy and ultimately given a contract, a paperclip contract, with the U.S. Department of Energy.
I note he even restored the money Hitler had paid Ambrose.
I mean, that, you know, when war criminals were convicted during the Nazi war criminal trials, their money was taken from them. And in the case of Ambrose, that included what was left of that million Reichsmarks bonus from Hitler. By the way, that was a detail, sort of a piece of paper, an award I found sort of fell out of Ambrose's classified file, which is now declassified at the National Archives. But I had never seen that anywhere before. It was that was a wow moment to see that he had been given that money by Hitler. And then to learn that that money had been confiscated from him, but when he was given clemency, that money was restored. I tried to find out from Ambrose's son what happened to that money, because I traced the trail after Ambrose was released. He purchased a villa in Switzerland, where he would spend holidays. And I tried to find out if that was the money You know, that had come. Yes. But the son who followed in the father's footsteps in that case said to me that was a private family matter.
Annie, the number 1600 is a pretty accurate number for the total number of scientists who would have gone through Operation Paperclip in the years after World War II?
I would have to say no. Okay. I mean, I would say that's accurate today. Mm-hmm. Because that's, you know, the number counting of the declassified documents. But I have a feeling that Paperclip is much larger than any of us know. And I have a feeling that, you know, or and I would hope, because of course my book is written on the shoulders of many great journalists, historians, researchers, reporters who have come before me to try to, you know, get in the crevices of the truth about this story. And I would hope that my book would inspire journalists of the next generation to look into this further, because many of the documents are still classified.
And how did the set that you worked with become declassified? Just for a moment on this. This happened during the Clinton years, right?
Yes. Well, lots of, you know, they've been sort of different journalists. Linda Hunt comes to mind.
Right.
Very intrepid folks have worked doggedly to get different files declassified. But the Nazi War Crimes Disclosure Act under the Clinton administration, you know, put another thrust through the declassification process, and those files sort of became available to researchers starting in about 2005. But many of them remain classified. I mean, almost all of the CIA's documents remain classified, for example. And here's other examples. I mean, Otto Ambrose, Hitler's favorite chemist, I found out came to the United States 3 times. And that means that the State Department had to give him special visa documentation because he was a convicted Nazi war criminal. And so trying to get those files from the State Department was a whole, you know, a whole hunt in itself. And ultimately, they had no files. And you have to really say to yourself, well, where are those files? If they don't have them, who does?
Now, as we noted during our conversation here, there was some press reporting about certain of these German scientists back in the 40s, late 40s and the 50s. But it doesn't sound like there was ever a massive public hue and cry against this, the idea. It sounds like the public relations arm of the Pentagon did its work effectively.
Yes, for the most part, yes. But going back to, you know, the idea of Einstein, I mean, he's ultimately, people sometimes ask me the question, well, what were we supposed to do? You know, what were these scientists supposed to do? And for me, the wonderful example of what, and again, this is, you know, very easy to say in my shoes, mind you, but the example is Einstein, because he left Germany when the Nazis took power. And he said, I'm paraphrasing, I am leaving because this country is now being controlled by a rabid mob of Nazi militia, and I'm out of here, essentially is what he said. And he came to the United States. And his position, Einstein's position, to Truman was, that's what all of the scientists should have done, because if they stayed, they were complicit. And he was an outspoken critic of the program with Eleanor Roosevelt.
Later, I'm talking about the 70s, the 80s, as veterans age, some of those thousands of men who were tested at Edgewood Arsenal, for instance, were, you know, guinea pigs, unwitting test subjects. Did any of them sue the government, complain to the government, ask for compensation of any kind because of health issues?
Well, it's very difficult to sue the government for a person in the military. And so there were some class action suits, and there were settlements, and there was money through the VA. But that program remains very controversial. And I think that's another example of documentation that will be revealed in the future and show more about the extent of needing that program to be kept secret for exactly those kind of reasons, which have to do with compensating people.
Aside from the government recruiting and bringing these scientists to the United States, did any corporations try to bring them over? Did any corporations, pick up the scientists once they were through with Operation Paperclip?
Absolutely. The corporations were, hand in glove with this, and I think that reveals that the military-industrial complex was in full force a full decade before Eisenhower spoke of it in his farewell speech. You see the different defense contractors, and this is in the documentation, working with the government to have access to these German scientists, and sometimes they would be told, well, their information's classified, and other times the scientists would be what was called seconded off to the defense contractors. In other words, the Army, for example, would have gotten all that it needed from, scientist A, and then send him off to either a university or a private defense contractor.
We're familiar here in Maryland with the Army's experiments, the CIA's experiments with LSD and other psychedelic drugs. Were German scientists involved in that as well, Annie?
Yes, what we spoke of earlier, Camp King, that mm-hmm. facility in Germany, was, as far as my research showed, perhaps the first example of where drugs were used in enhanced interrogation techniques. And that was a program that was run not just by CIA, but by Army, Navy, and the Air Force, all working together. I write about this at length in the book because these were what is now known as MK Ultra, that sort of nefarious CIA program, mm-hmm. actually has its origins in two earlier programs that are called Operation Artichoke and Operation Bluebird. And lo and behold, the two doctors who were in charge of the post facility at Camp King were Dr. Walter Schreiber, the Surgeon General of the Third Reich, and Dr. Kurt Blome, the Deputy Surgeon General of the Third Reich.
And we mentioned Lukes, Brigadier General Charles Lukes, right? I mean, he was at Camp King as well.
Absolutely. He would come and go at Camp King. He was holding these roundtable discussions at his home in Heidelberg with Hitler's favorite chemist. He would go back to Camp King and work with Schreiber. There was, because what's interesting is the Chemical Corps was actually in charge of the biological weapons program. So they were the umbrella. Lukes kind of worked as the umbrella, the eagle eye, so to speak, sourcing these paperclip scientists who would then wind up in America.
Did any of the famous Nazi hunters do anything about this operation in the United States, complain to the government about it, seek to have some of these scientists tried?
Yes. I mean, some of Simon Wiesenthal, for example, wrote specifically to the Counterintelligence Corps about individual scientists, usually doctors, those who actually worked or were suspected of working in the concentration camps performing medical experiments. A number of them, including the highest ranking doctor, Dr. Hubertus Strughold, known as the father of space medicine in America, he was looked at by Wiesenthal many, many times. You see lots of documentation going back and forth to try to get more information on him. And he's a very controversial figure that I write about in the book. Still, the United States government, considers him, or many consider him, a hero, and an award is given out in his name.
Annie Jacobson, I want to congratulate you on a great book, and thank you for spending some time talking about it with us. Thank you, Annie.
Thank you.
Annie Jacobson, her book, Operation Paperclip, The Secret Intelligence Program That Brought Nazi Scientists to America. It's published by Little Brown. As I mentioned earlier, it's hard to read the book without a growing sense of outrage on almost every page. It's quite an accomplishment, this book. So thank you, everybody. And thank you for tuning in to Midday today and all week long here on WYPR. Dan Rodericks for our staff. We'll see you all again soon.
Midday's senior producer is Nikki Gamer. The producer and director is Jonathan Ahrens. The associate producer, Michael Himowitz. Our interns are Luke Spicknell, James Daly, Tom Cartaxo, and Michelle Richardson. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.